Lutzer knocked at the door of a rough but large shed built up right against the wall. At the same moment there was an explosion within, and someone, Lobsang corrected himself, half of someone, tumbled very fast out of the unglazed window beside it and hit the path with bone-cracking force. Only when it stopped rolling did he realize that it was a wooden dummy in a monk's robe.
"He's having fun, I see," said Lutzer.
He hadn't moved as the dummy had sailed past his ear. The door burst open, and a plump old monk looked out excitedly.
"Did you see that? Did you see that?" he said. "And that was with just one spoonful."
He nodded at them.
"Oh, hello, Lutzer. I was expecting you. I've got some things ready."
"Got what?" said Lobsang.
"Who's the boy?"
said Q, ushering them in.
"The untutored child is called Lobsang,"
said Lutzer, looking around the shed. There was a smoking circle on the stone floor, with drifts of blackened sand around it.
"New toys, Q?" "Exploding mandala," said Q happily, bustling forward. "Just sprinkle the special sand on the simple design anywhere you like, and the first enemy to walk on it, bang, instant karma. Don't touch that!"
Lutzer reached across and snatched from Lobsang's inquisitive hands the begging bowl he had just picked up from a table.
"Remember Rule 1,
he said, and hurled the bowl across the room. Hidden blades slid out as it spun, and the bowl buried itself in a beam.
"That would take a man's head right off,"
said Lobsang, and then they heard the faint ticking.
3, 4, 5,
said Q.
"Everybody duck, now!"
Lutzer pushed Lobsang to the floor a moment before the bowl exploded. Metal fragments scythed overhead.
"I added just a little something extra since you last saw it,"
said Q proudly, as they got to their feet again.
"A very versatile device. Plus, of course, you can use it to eat rice out of. Oh, have you seen this?"
He picked up a prayer drum. Both Lutzer and Lobsang took a step back. Q twirled the drum a few times, and the weighted cords patted against the skins.
"The cord can be instantly removed for a handy garrote," he said. "And the drum itself can be removed, like so, to reveal this useful dagger.
Plus, of course, you can use it to pray with," said Lobsang.
"Well spotted," said Hugh. "Quick boy. Prayer is always useful in the last resort. In fact, we've been working on a very promising mantra incorporating sonic tones that have a particular effect on the human nervous system."
"I don't think we need any of this stuff, Hugh," said Lutzer. Hugh sighed.
"At least you could let us turn your broom into a secret weapon, Lutzer. I've shown you the plans."
"It is a secret weapon," said Lutzer. "It's a broom."
"How about the new yaks we've been breeding? At the touch of a rein, their horns will instantly..."
"We want a spinner's cue." The monk suddenly looked guilty.
"Spinner? What spinner?"
Lutzer walked across the room and pressed a hand against part of the wall which slid aside.
"These spinners, Q. Now don't muck me about. We haven't got time."
Lobsang saw what looked very much like two small procrastinators, each one within a metal framework mounted on a board. There was a harness attached to each board.
"You haven't told the abbot about them yet, have you?"
said Lutzer, unhooking one of the things.
"He'd put a stop to them if you did. You know that." "I didn't think anyone knew," said Q. "How did you?"
Lutzer grinned.
"No one notices the sweeper," he said. "Well, it's still very experimental,"
said Q, close to panic.
"I was going to tell the abbot, of course, but I was waiting until I had something to demonstrate, and it would be terrible if they fell into the wrong hands."
"Then we'll see to it that they don't," said Lutzer, examining the straps. "How are they powered now?"
Weights and wrenches were too unreliable," said Q. "I'm afraid I had to resort to clockwork."
Lutzer stiffened, and he glared at the monk.
"Clockwork? Only as a motive force, only as a motive force,"
the Q protested.
"Well, there's really no other choice."
"Too late now, it'll have to do,"
said Lutzer, unhooking the other board and passing it across to Lobsang.
"There you go, lad. With a bit of sacking round it, it'll look just like a backpack."
"But what is it?" Q sighed.
"They're portable procrastinators. Try not to break them, please."
"What would we need them for?" I hope you don't have to find out, said Luther. Thanks, Q.
Are you sure you wouldn't prefer some time bombs? Said Q, hopefully. Drop one on the floor and time will slow for...
Thanks, but no.
The other monks were fully equipped, said Q.
But we're travelling light, said Lutzer firmly. We'll go out the back way, Q, okay?
The back way led to a very narrow path and a small gate in the wall. Dismembered wooden dummies and patches of scorched rock indicated that Q and his assistants often came this way. And then there was another path beside one of the many icy streamlets.
Q means well, said Lutzer, walking fast. But if you listen to him, you end up clanking when you walk and exploding when you sit down.
Lobsang ran to keep up. It'll take weeks to walk to Ankh-Morpork, Porksweeper.
We'll slice our way there, said Lutzer,
and he stopped and turned.
You think you can do that?
I've done it hundreds of times,
Lobsang began.
Back in Oidong, yeah,
said Lutzer.
But there's all kinds of checks and safeguards in the valley.
Oh, didn't you know that?
Slicing in Oidong is easy, lad. Different out here.
The air tries to get in the way.
Do it wrong, and the air is a rock. You have to shape the slice around you so that you move like a fish in the water. Know how to do that?
Well, we learned a bit of the theory, but...
Soto said you stopped time for yourself back in the city. The stance of the coyote, it's called. Very hard to do, and I don't reckon they teach it in the Thieves' Guild, eh?
Well, I suppose I was lucky, Sweeper.
Good. Keep it up. We'll have plenty of time for you to practice before we leave the snow.
Get it right by before you tread on the grass or kiss your feet goodbye.
They called it slicing time. There is a way of playing certain musical instruments that is called circular breathing, devised to allow people to play the didgeridoo or the bagpipe without actually imploding or being sucked down the tube. Slicing time was very much the same, except time was substituted for air, and it was a lot quieter. A trained monk would stretch a second further than an hour. But that wasn't enough. He'd be moving in a rigid world. He'd have to learn to see by echolight and hear by ghost sound and let time leap into his immediate universe. It wasn't hard once he found the confidence. The sliced world could almost seem normal, apart from the colours. It was like walking in sunset, although the sun was fixed high in the sky and barely moved. The world ahead shaded toward violet, and the world behind, when Lobsang looked round, was the shade of old blood. And it was lonely. But the worst of it, Lobsang realized, was the silence. There was noise of a sort, but it was just a deep sizzle at the edge of hearing. His footsteps sounded strange and muffled, and the sound arrived in his ears out of sync with the tread of his feet. They reached the edge of the valley and stepped out of the perpetual springtime into the real world of the snows. Now the cold crept in, slowly, like a sadist's knife. Lutzer strode on ahead, seemingly oblivious to it. Of course, that was one of the stories about him. Lutzer, it was said, would walk for miles during weather when the clouds themselves would freeze and crash out of the sky. Cold did not affect him, they said. And yet, in the stories, Lutzer had been bigger, stronger, not a skinny little bald man who preferred not to fight. Sweeper! Lutzer stopped and turned. His outline blurred slightly, and Lobsang unwrapped himself from time. Color came back into the world. And while the cold ceased to have the force of a drill, it still struck hard.
Yes, lad?
You're going to teach me, right?
If there's anything left that you don't know, wonder boy, said Lutzer dryly.
You're slicing well, I can see that. I don't know how you can stand this cold.
Ah, you don't know the secret?
Is it the way of Mrs. Cosmopolite that gives you such power?
Lutzer hitched up his robe and did a little dance in the snow, revealing skinny legs encased in thick, yellowing tubes.
Very good, he said. She still sends me these double-knit combinations, silk on the inside, then three layers of wool, reinforced gussets, and a couple of handy trapdoors. Very reasonably priced at $6 a pair because I'm an old customer. For it is written,
Wrap up warm, or you'll catch your death.
It's just a trick. Lutzer looked surprised.
What? He said.
Well, I mean, it's all tricks, isn't it? Everyone thinks you're a great hero, and you don't fight, and they think you possess all kinds of strange knowledge, and it's just tricking people, isn't it? Even the abbot. I thought you'd teach me things worth knowing.
Well, I've got her address, if that's what you want. If you mention my name. Oh, I see. You don't mean that, right?
Look, I don't want to be ungrateful. I just thought...
You thought I should use mysterious powers derived from a lifetime of study just to keep my legs warm, eh?
Well,
debase the sacred teachings for the sake of my knees, you think?
If you put it like that...
Then something made Lobstang look down. He was standing in 6 inches of snow. Lutzer was not. His sandals were standing in 2 puddles. The ice was melting away around his toes, his pink, warm toes.
Toes? Now, that's another matter, said the sweeper. Mrs. Cosmopolite is a wizard with long johns, but she can't turn a heel worth a damn.
Lobsang looked up into a wink.
Always remember Rule 1, eh?
Lutzer patted the shaken boy on the arm.
But you're doing well, he said. Let's have a quiet sit down and a brew up.
He pointed to some rocks that at least offered some protection from the wind. Snow had piled up against them in big white mounds.
Lutzer?
Yes, lad?
I've got a question. Can you give me a straight answer?
Oh, I'll try, of course.
What the hell is going on?
Lutzer brushed the snow off a rock.
Oh, he said. One of the difficult questions.
Igor had to admit it. When it came to getting weird things done, sane beat mad hands down. He'd been used to masters who, despite doing wonderful handstands on the edge of the mental catastrophe curve, couldn't put their own trousers on without a map. Like all Igors, he'd learned how to deal with them. In truth, it wasn't a difficult job, although sometimes you had to work the graveyard shift, and once you got them settled into their routine, you could get on with your own work and they wouldn't bother you until the lightning rod needed raising. It wasn't like that with Jeremy. He was truly a man you could set your watch by. Igor had never seen a life so organized, so slimmed down, so timed. He found himself thinking of his new master as the TikTok man. One of Igor's former masters had made a TikTok man, all levers and gear wheels and cranks and clockwork. Instead of a brain, it had a long tape punched with holes. Instead of a heart, it had a big spring. Provided everything in the kitchen was very carefully positioned, the thing could sweep the floor and make a passable cup of tea. If it wasn't carefully positioned, or if the ticking, clicking thing hit an unexpected bump, then it'd strip the plaster off the walls and make a furious cup of cat. Then his master had conceived the idea of making the thing live, so that it could punch its own tapes and wind its own spring. Igor, who knew exactly when to follow instructions to the letter, dutifully rigged up the classic rising table and lightning rod arrangement on the evening of a really good storm. He didn't see exactly what happened thereafter, because he wasn't there when the lightning hit the clockwork. No, Igor was at a dead run halfway down the hill to the village, with all his possessions in a carpet bag. Even so, a white-hot cogwheel had whirred over his head and buried itself in a tree trunk. Loyalty to a master was very important, but it took second place to loyalty to Igordom. If the world was going to be full of lurching servants, then they were damn well going to be called Igor. It seemed to this Igor that if you could make a TikTok man live, he'd be like Jeremy, and Jeremy was ticking faster as the clock neared completion. Igor didn't much like the clock. He was a people person. He preferred things that bled. And as the clock grew with its shimmering crystal part that didn't seem entirely all here, so Jeremy grew more absorbed and Igor grew more tense. There was definitely something new happening here, and Igors were avid to learn new things. But there were limits. Igor did not believe in forbidden knowledge and things man was not meant to know. But obviously there were some things a man was not meant to know, such as what it felt like to have every single particle of your body sucked into a little hole, and that seemed to be one of the options available in the immediate future. And then there was Lady Lejeune. She gave Igor the willies, and he was a man not usually subject to even the smallest willy. She wasn't a zombie, and she wasn't a vampire, because she didn't smell like one. She didn't smell like anything. In Igor's experience, everything smelled like something. And there was the other matter.
"Her feet don't touch the ground, though," he said.
"Of course they do," said Jeremy, buffing up part of the mechanism with his sleeve. "She'll be here again in a minute and 17 seconds, and I'm sure her feet will be touching the ground."
"Oh, sometimes they do, though. But you watch when she goes up or down a step, though. She doesn't get it exactly right, though. You can just see the shadow under her toes."
"Toes?"
"On her feet, though,"
sighed Igor. The lisp could be a problem, and in truth any Igor could easily fix it, but it was part of being an Igor. You might as well stop limping.
"Go and get ready by the door," said Jeremy. "Floating in the air doesn't make you a bad person."
Igor shrugged. He was entertaining the idea that it didn't mean you were a person at all, and, incidentally, rather worried that Jeremy seemed to have dressed himself with a little more care this morning. He'd decided, in these circumstances, not to broach the subject of his hiring, but he had been working that one out. He'd been hired before his ladyship had engaged Jeremy to do this work? Well, all that showed was that she knew her man. But she'd hired him in bad shoeshine herself. And he'd got himself onto the mail coach that very day, and it turned out that Lady Lejeune had visited Jeremy on that day, too. The only thing faster than the mail coach between Uberfelt and Ankh-Morpork was magic, unless someone had found a way to travel by semaphore, and Lejeune hardly looked like a witch. The shop's clocks were putting up a barrage of noise to signal the passing of 7 o'clock when Igor opened the front door. It always did, to anticipate the knock.
Not did anything, just did. Some things were done, and some things were not done. And the things that were done, Igor's did.
That was another part of the code of the Igors. He wrenched it open.
2 pints, sir, lovely and fresh, said Mr. Soap, handing him the bottle. And a day like this just says fresh cream, doesn't it?
Igor glared at him, but took the bottle.
I prefer it when it's going green, he said haughtily. Good day to you, Mr. Soak.
He shut the door. It wasn't her, said Jeremy when he arrived back in the workshop.
It was the milkman, sir.
She's 25 seconds late, said Jeremy, looking concerned. Do you think anything could have happened to her?
Real ladies are often fashionably late, sir,
said Igor, putting the milk away. It was icy cold under his fingers.
Well, I'm sure her ladyship is a real lady.
I wouldn't know about that, sir,
said Igor, who in fact had the aforesaid very strong doubts in that area. He walked back into the shop and got ready with his hand on the handle just as the knock came. Lady Lejeune swept past Igor. The two trolls ignored him and took up their positions just inside the workshop. Igor put them down as hired rock, anyone's for $2 a day plus walking around money. Her ladyship was impressed. The big clock was nearing completion. It wasn't the squat, blocky thing that Igor's grandfather had told him about. Jeremy had, much to Igor's surprise, for there wasn't a scrap of decoration anywhere in the house, gone for the impressive look.
Your grandfather helped to make the first one, Jeremy had said. So let's build a grandfather's clock, eh?
And there it stood. A slim, long-case clock in crystal and spun glass, reflecting the light in worrying ways. Igor had spent a fortune in the street of cunning artificers. For enough money, you could buy anything in Ankh-Morpork, and that included people. He'd made sure that no crystal cutter or glass worker had done enough of the work to give them any sort of clue about the finished clock, but he'd worried needlessly about that. Money could buy a lot of disinterest. Besides, who would believe you could measure time with crystals? Only in the workshop did it all come together. Igor bustled around, polishing things, listening carefully as Jeremy showed off his creation.
No need for any metal parts, he was saying. We've come up with a way of making the tamed lightning flow across glass, and we found a workman who can make glass that bends slightly.
We, Igor noticed. Well, that was always the way of it. We discovering things meant the master asking for them and Igor thinking them up. Anyway, the flow of lightning was a family passion. With sand and chemicals and a few secrets, you could make lightning sit up and beg. Lady Lejeune reached out with a gloved hand and touched the side of the clock.
This is the divider mechanism, Jeremy began, picking up a crystalline array from the workbench.
But her ladyship was still staring up at the clock.
You've given it a face and hands, she said.
Why?
Oh, it will function very well in the measurement of traditional time, said Jeremy. Glass gears throughout, of course. In theory, it will never need adjusting. It will take its time from the universal tick.
Ah, you found it, then.
The time it takes the smallest possible thing that can happen to happen. I know it exists.
She looked almost impressed.
But the clock is still unfinished.
There is a certain amount of trial and error, said Jeremy.
But we will do it. Igor says there will be a big storm on Monday. That should provide the power, he says. And then,
Jeremy's face lit up with a smile,
I see no reason why every clock in the world shouldn't say precisely the same time.
Lady Lejeune glanced at Igor, who bustled with renewed haste.
The servant is satisfactory?
Oh, he grumbles a bit, but he has got a good heart, and a spare, apparently. He is amazingly skilled in all crafts, too.
Yes, Igors generally are, said the lady distantly. They seem to have mastered the art of inheriting talent.
She snapped her fingers, and one of the trolls stepped forward and produced a couple of bags.
Gold and Invar, she said, as promised.
Ah, but Invar will be worthless when we've finished the clock, said Jeremy.
Well, sorry, you want more gold?
No, you've been very generous. Right, thought Igor, dusting the workbench vigorously.
Until next time, then, said Lady Lejeune.
The trolls were already turning toward the door.
You'll be here for the start, said Jeremy,
as Igor hurried into the hall to get the front door open, because whatever he thought about her ladyship, there was such a thing as tradition.
Possibly, but we have every confidence in you, Jeremy.
Igor stiffened. He hadn't heard that tone in Jeremy's voice. In the voice of a master, it was a bad tone. Jeremy took a deep, nervous breath, as if contemplating some minute and difficult piece of clockwork that would, without tremendous care, unwind catastrophically and spray cogwheels across the floor.
I was wondering, your ladyship, perhaps, you would like to take dinner with me, tonight,
Jeremy smiled. Igor had seen better smiles on a corpse. Lady Lejeune's expression flickered. It really did. It seemed to Igor to go from one expression to another as if they were a series of still pictures, with no perceptible movement of the features between each one. It went from her usual blankness to sudden thoughtfulness, and then all the way to amazement, and then, to Igor's own astonishment, it began to blush.
Why, Mr. Jeremy, I don't know what to say.
Her ladyship stammered, her icy composure turning into a warm puddle.
I don't know. Perhaps some other time. I do have an important engagement. So glad to have met you. I must be going. Goodbye.
Igor stood stiffly to attention, as upright as the average Igor could manage, and almost shut the door behind her ladyship as she hurried out of the building down the steps. She ended up just for a moment half an inch above the street. It was only for a moment, and then she drifted downward. No one except Igor, glaring balefully through the crack between door and frame, could possibly have noticed. He darted back into the workshop. Jeremy still stood transfixed, blushing as pinkly as her ladyship had done.
I'll just be nipping out to get that new glass work for the multiplier, sir,
Igor said quickly.
It should be done by now, yes?
Jeremy spun on his heel and marched very quickly over to the workbench.
You do that, Igor. Thank you,
he said, his voice slightly muffled. Lady Lejeune's party were down the street when Igor slipped out and moved quickly into the shadows. At the crossroad, her ladyship waved one hand vaguely, and the trolls headed off by themselves. Igor stayed with her. For all the trademark limp, Igor's could move fast when they had to. They often had to when the mob hit the windmill.
Igor's were loyal, but they were not stupid. Job was a job. When an employer had no further use for your services, for example, because he'd just been staked through the heart by a crowd of angry villagers, it was time to move on before they decided that you ought to be on the next stake. Igor soon learned a secret way out of any castle and where to stash an overnight bag. In the words of one of the founding Igors, "We belong dead? Well, excuse me, where does it say we?"
Out in the open, he could see more wrong things. She didn't move quite right. It was as though she was controlling her body, rather than letting it control itself. That's what humans did. Even zombies got the hang of things after a while. The effect was subtle, but Igor's had very good eyesight. She moved like someone unused to wearing skin. The quarry headed down a narrow street, and Igor half hoped that some of the Thieves' Guild were around. He'd very much like to see what happened if one of them gave her the tap on the noggin that was their prelude to negotiation. One had tried it with Igor yesterday, and if the man had been surprised at the metallic clang, he'd been astonished to have his arm grabbed and broken with anatomical exactitude. In fact, she turned into an alleyway between a couple of the buildings. Igor hesitated. Letting yourself be outlined in the daylight at the mouth of an alley was item one on the local checklist of death. But on the other hand, he wasn't actually doing anything wrong, was he? And she didn't look armed. There was no sound of footsteps in the alley. He waited a moment and stuck his head around the corner. There was no sign of Lady Lejean. There was also no way out of the alley. It was a dead end, full of rubbish. But there was a fading gray shape in the air that vanished even as he stared. It was a hooded robe, gray as fog. It merged into the general gloom and disappeared. She turned into an alleyway, and then she turned into something else. Igor felt his hands twitch. Individual Igors might have their particular specialties, but all of them were expert surgeons and had an inbuilt desire not to see anybody wasted. Up in the mountains, where most of the employment was for woodchoppers and miners, having an Igor living locally was considered very fortunate. There was always the risk of an axe bouncing or a saw blade running wild, and then a man was glad to have an Igor around who could lend a hand, or even an entire arm if you were lucky. And while they practiced their skills freely and generously in the community, the Igors were even more careful to use it among themselves. Magnificent eyesight, a stout pair of lungs, a wonderful digestive system. It was terrible to think of such exquisite workmanship going to the worms. So they made sure it didn't. They kept it in the family. Igor really did have his grandfather's hand. And now they were bunching into fists, all by themselves.
A very small kettle burned on a fire of wood shavings and dried yak dung.
"It was a long time ago," said Lutzer. "Exactly when doesn't matter because of what happened. In fact, asking exactly when doesn't make any sense anymore. Depends on where you are. In some places, it was hundreds of years ago. Some other places, well, maybe it hasn't happened yet. There was this man in Oberfeld. He invented a clock. An amazing clock. It measured the tick of the universe. Know what that is? No, me neither. The Aversi amount for that kind of stuff. Let me see. Okay, think of the smallest amount of time that you can. Really small. So tiny that a second would be like a billion years. Got that? Well, the cosmic quantum tick, and that's what the other calls it, the cosmic quantum tick is much smaller than that. It's the time it takes to go from now to then. The time it takes an atom to think of wobbling. It's the time it takes for the smallest thing that's possible to happen, said Lobsang. Exactly. Well done, said Lutzer. He took a deep breath. It's also the time it takes for the whole universe to be destroyed in the past and rebuilt in the future. Now don't look at me like that. That's what the abbot said. Has it been happening while we've been talking? said Lobsang. Millions of times. An oodleplex of times, probably.
How many's that?
Oh, it's one of the abbot's words. It means more numbers than you can imagine in a yonk.
But what's a yonk?
A very long time.
And we don't feel it? The universe is destroyed and we don't feel it?
Well, they say not. The first time it was explained to me, I got a bit jumpy, but it's far too quick for us to notice.
Lobsang stared at the snow for a while. Then he said, all right, go on.
Someone in Uberfeld built this clock out of glass, powered by lightning, as I recall. It somehow got down to a level where it could tick with the universe.
But why did he want to do that?
Listen, he lived in a big old castle on a crag in Uberfeld. People like that don't need a reason apart from because I can. They have a nightmare and try to make it happen.
But look, you can't make a clock like that because it's inside the universe, so it'll get rebuilt when the universe does, right?
Lutza looked impressed and said so.
I'm impressed, he said.
It'd be like opening a box with a crowbar that's inside. The abbot believes part of the clock was outside, though.
You can't have something outside.
Tell that to a man who's been working on the problem for 9 lifetimes, said Lutza. You want to hear the rest of the story?
Yes, Sweeper.
So, we were spread pretty thin in those days, but there was this young sweeper.
You, said Lobsang. This is going to be you, right?
Yes, yes, said Lutza testily. I was sent to Uberfeld. History hadn't diverged much in those days, and we knew something big was going to happen around Bad Shoeshine. I must have spent weeks looking. You know how many remote castles there are along the gorges? You can't move for remote castles.
That's why you didn't find the right one in time, said Lobsang. I remember what you told the abbot.
Well, I was just down in the valley when the lightning struck the tower, said Lutza. You know it is written, big events always cast their shadows. But I couldn't detect where it was happening until too late. 0.5 mile sprint uphill faster than a lightning bolt. Well, no one could do that. Nearly made it, though. I was actually through the door when it all went to hell.
There's no point in blaming yourself, then.
Yes, but you know how it is. You keep thinking, if only I'd got up earlier, or had gone a different way, said Lutza.
And the clock struck? Said Lobsang.
No, it stuck. I told you part of it was outside the universe. It wouldn't go with the flow. It was trying to count the tick, not move with it. Oh, but the universe is huge. It can't be stopped by a piece of clockwork.
Lutza flicked the end of his cigarette into the fire.
Well, the abbot says the size wouldn't make any difference at all, he said. Look, it's taken him 9 lifetimes to know what he knows, so it's not our fault if we can't understand it, is it? History shattered. It was the only thing that could give. Very strange thing. There were cracks left all over the place. The fastenings, which tell bits of the past, which bits of the present they belong to, they were all flapping all over the place. Some got lost forever.
Lutza stared into the dying flames.
We stitched it up as best we could, he added. Up and down history, filling up holes with bits of time taken from somewhere else. It's a patchwork, really.
But didn't people notice?
Why should they? Once we'd done it, it had always been like that. You'd be amazed what we got away with. For instance, I'm sure they spot it somehow.
Lutza gave Lobsang one of his sidelong glances.
Funny you should say that. I've always wondered about it. People say things like, where did the time go? And it seems like only yesterday. Now we have to do it anyway. And it's healed up very nicely.
But people would look in the history books and see
words, lad. That's all. Anyway, people have been messing around with time ever since they were people. Wasting it, killing it, bearing it, making it up. And they do it. People's heads were made to play with time. Just like we do, except we're better trained and have a few extra skills, and we've spent centuries working to bring it all back in line. You watch the procrastinators even on a quiet day. Moving time, stretching it here, compressing it there, it's a big job.
I'm not going to see it smashed a second time. A second time? There won't be enough left to repair.
He stared at the embers.
Funny thing, he said. Wen himself had some very funny ideas about time come the finish. Wrote some very strange stuff. He reckoned time was alive. He said it acted like a living thing anyway. Very strange ideas indeed. He said he'd met time, and she was a woman. To him, anyway. Everyone says that was just a very complicated metaphor, and maybe I was just hit on the head or something, but on that day I looked at the glass clock just as it exploded, and...
He stood up and grabbed his broom.
Best foot forward, lad. Another 2 or 3 seconds and we'll be down in Bong Phut.
What were you going to say? Said Lobsang, hurrying to his feet.
Oh, just an old man rambling, said Lutzer. The mind wanders a bit when you get over 700. Let's get moving.
Sweeper?
Yes, lad.
Why are we carrying spinners on our backs?
All in good time, lad, I hope.
We're carrying time, right? If time stops, we can keep going? Like divers?
Full marks.
And another question. Time is a she? Well, none of the teachers have mentioned it, and I don't recall anything in the scrolls.
Don't you think about that. Wen wrote, well, the secret scroll, it's called. They keep it in a locked room. Only the abbots and the most senior monks ever get to see it.
Lobsang couldn't let that one pass. So how did you... he began.
Well, you wouldn't expect men like that to do the sweeping up in there, would you? Said Lutzer. Terribly dusty it got.
What was it about?
Oh, I didn't read much of it. Didn't feel it was right, said Lutzer.
You?
What was it about, then? It was a love poem, and it was a good one.
Lutzer's image blurred as he sliced time. Then it faded and vanished. A line of footprints appeared across the snowfield. Lobsang wrapped time around himself and followed, and a memory came from nowhere at all. Wen was right.
There were lots of places like the warehouse. There always are in every old city, no matter how valuable the building land is. Sometimes space just gets lost. A workshop is built, and then another beside it. Factories and storerooms and sheds and temporary lean-tos crawl toward one another, meet, and merge. Spaces between outside walls are roofed with tar paper. Odd-shaped bits of ground are colonized by someone's nailing up a bit of wall and cutting a doorway. Old doorways are masked by piles of lumber or new tool racks. The old men who knew what was where move on and die, just like the flies who punctuate the thick cobwebs on the grubby windows. Young men in this noisome world of whirring lathes and paint shops and cluttered workbenches don't have time to explore. And so there are spaces like this, a small warehouse with a crusted skylight that no fewer than 4 factory owners think is owned by one of the other 3, when they think about it at all. In fact, each of them own 1 wall, and certainly no one now recalls who roofed the space. Beyond the walls on all 4 sides, men and dwarves bend iron, saw planks, make string, and turn screws. But in here is a silence known only to rats. The air moved, for the first time in years. Dust balls rolled across the floor. Little motes sparkled and spun in the light that forced its way down from the roof. In the surrounding area, invisible and subtle, matter began to move. It came from workmen's sandwiches and gutter dirt and pigeon feathers, an atom here, a molecule there, and streamed unheeded into the center of the space. It spiraled. Eventually it became, after passing through some strange, ancient, and horrible shapes, Lady Lejean. She staggered, but managed to stay upright. Other auditors also appeared, and as they did so, it seemed for the first time that they had never really not been there. The dead grayness of the light merely took on shapes. They emerge like ships from a fog. You stare at the fog, and suddenly part of the fog is Hull, which had been there all along, and now there is nothing for it but to race for the lifeboats. Lady Lejeune said, I cannot keep doing this. It is too painful. One said, Ah, can you tell us what pain is like? We have often wondered. No, no, I don't think I can. It is a body thing. It is not pleasant. From now on, I will retain the body. One said, That could be dangerous. Lady Lejeune shrugged. We have been through that before. It's only a matter of appearance, she said. And it is remarkable how much easier it is to deal with humans in this form. One said, You shrugged, and you are talking with your mouth, a hole for food and air. Yes, it is remarkable, isn't it? Lady Lejeune's body found an old crate, pulled it over, and sat on it. She hardly had to think about muscle movements at all. One said, You aren't eating, are you? As yet, no. One said, As yet, that raises the whole dreadful subject of orifices. One said, And how did you learn to shrug? It comes with the body, said her ladyship. We never realized this, did we? Most of the things it appears to do automatically. Standing upright takes no effort whatsoever. The whole business gets easier every time. The body shifted position slightly and crossed its legs. Amazing, she thought. It did it to be comfortable. I didn't have to think about it at all. We never guessed. One said, There will be questions. The auditors hated questions. They hated them almost as much as they hated decisions, and they hated decisions almost as much as they hated the idea of the individual personality. But what they hated most was things moving around randomly. Believe me, everything will be fine, said Lady Lejeune. We will not be breaking any of the rules after all. All that will happen is that time will stop. Everything thereafter will be neat, alive, but not moving. Tidy. One said, And we can get the filing finished. Exactly, said Lady Lejeune. And he wants to do it. That is the strange thing. He hardly thinks about the consequences. One said, Splendid. There was one of those pauses when no one is quite ready to speak yet, and then one said, Tell us, what is it like? What is what like? One said, Being insane, being human. Strange, disorganized. Several levels of thinking go on at once. There are things we have no word for. For example, the idea of eating seems now to have an attraction. The body tells me this. One said, Attraction? As in gravity? Yes, one is drawn toward food. One said, Food in large masses? Even in small amounts? One said, But eating is simply a function. What is the attraction of performing a function? Surely the knowledge that it is necessary for continued survival is sufficient. I cannot say, said Lady Lejeune. One auditor said, You persist in using a personal pronoun. And one added, And you have not died. To be an individual is to live, and to live is to die. Yes, I know. But it is essential for humans to use the personal pronoun. It divides the universe into two parts, the darkness behind the eyes, where the little voice is, and everything else. It is a horrible feeling. It is like being questioned all the time. One said, What is the little voice? Sometimes thinking is like talking to another person, but that person is also you. She could tell this disturbed the other auditors. I do not wish to continue in this way any longer than necessary, she added, and realized that she had lied. One said, We do not blame you. Lady Lejeune nodded. The auditors could see into human minds. They could see the pop and sizzle of the thoughts, but they could not read them. They could see the energies flow from node to node. They could see the brain glittering like a hog-swatch decoration. What they couldn't see was what was happening. So they built one. It was the logical thing to do. They'd used human agents before, because early on they'd worked out that there were many, many humans who would do anything for sufficient gold. This was puzzling, because gold did not seem to the auditors to hold any significant value for a human body. It needed iron and copper and zinc, but only the most minute traces of gold. Therefore, they'd reasoned, this was further evidence that the humans that required it were flawed, and this was why attempts to make use of them were doomed. But why were they flawed? Building a human being was easy. The auditors knew exactly how to move matter around. The trouble was that the result didn't do anything but lie there and eventually decompose. This was annoying, since clearly human beings without any special training or education seemed to be able to make working replicas quite easily. Then they learned that they could make a human body which worked if an auditor was inside it. There were, of course, huge risks. Death was one of them. The auditors avoided death by never going so far as to get a life. They strove to be as indistinguishable as hydrogen atoms, and with none of the latter's joie de vivre. Some luckless auditor might be risking death by operating the body. But lengthy consultation decided that if the driver took care and liaised at all times with the rest of the auditors, this was minimal and worth taking, considering the goal. They built a woman. It was a logical choice. After all, while men wielded more obvious power than women, they often did so at the expense of personal danger, and no auditor liked the prospect of personal danger. Beautiful women often achieved great things, on the other hand, merely by smiling at powerful men. The whole subject of beauty caused the auditors a lot of difficulty. It made no sense at a molecular level. But research turned up the fact that the woman in the picture, Woman Holding Ferret, by Leonard of Quirm, was considered the epitome of beauty, and so they based Lady Lejeune on that. They had made changes, of course. The face in the picture was asymmetrical and full of minor flaws, which they had carefully removed. The result would have been successful beyond the auditor's wildest dreams, if they'd ever dreamed. Now that they had their stalking horse, their reliable human, anything was possible. They were learning fast, or at least collecting data, which they considered to be the same as learning. So was Lady Lejeune. She had been a human for 2 weeks, two astonishing, shocking weeks. Whoever would have guessed that a brain operated like this, or that colors had a meaning that went way, way beyond spectral analysis? How could she even begin to describe the blueness of blue, or how much thinking the brain did all by itself? It was terrifying. Half the time her thoughts seemed not to be her own. She had been quite surprised to find that she did not want to tell the other auditors this. She did not want to tell them a lot of things. And she didn't have to. She had power. Oh, over Jeremy, that was not in question, and was now, she had to admit, rather worrying. It was causing her body to do things by itself, like blush. But she had power over the other auditors, too. She made them nervous. Of course she wanted the project to work. It was their goal, a tidy and predictable universe where everything stayed in its place. If auditors dreamed, this would be another dream. Except, the young man had smiled at her in a nervous, worrying way, and the universe was turning out to be a lot more chaotic than even the auditors had ever suspected. A lot of the chaos was happening inside Lady Lejeune's head.
End of side 7.